Hello, this is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 912-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as a program it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we begin this week's Triangle Business Journal with the biz page, as usual. And under the heading of Big Brother comes the article, Mark O'Meara Recalls His Time on Tour with Tiger Woods. Golf professional and two-time major champion Mark O'Meara considers Tiger Woods his little brother, even now. I don't talk to him as often anymore because we're playing different tours, and his professional obligations have quadrupled, says the 62-year-old golfer, who's playing the Champion Tour's SAS Championship event in Kerry. Biz sensed a bit of sadness in O'Meara's voice as he talked about the lack of communication with Woods in recent years, but he was quick to recall memories from early in Woods' career. Most people knew me as Woods' big brother. Well, I acted like one, O'Meara laughs as he recalled an episode in 1998 after winning the British Open. We were flying back in Woods' plane, and I desperately wanted to show off to Tiger my claret jug, that's the British Open trophy, and he would have none of it, he recalls. And when he finally looked at the trophy, I told him that his name would be there one day. Well, I was wrong. His name is there three times. O'Meara warns the current crop of golfers never to underestimate Woods. Don't ever say to him he can't do something, because that's the first thing he will do just to prove you wrong, he says. We all know what happened at the Masters this year. And under the heading of Hotspot comes the article, Still Selling Hot Dogs and Now Much More. Shorty's Famous Hot Dogs started in downtown Wake Forest in 1916 as a place to see films and get something out to eat. Its red hot dogs soon became a favorite, and Chris Joyner and a staff of two keep the hot dogs coming, along with sandwiches, hamburgers, and even chicken salad. Wake Forest has exploded, and Joyner says his business had been steadily growing over the last 10 years, going up about 6-8% per year. We get a little bit busier and busier every year, he says. We get a lot of new customers. And under the heading of growing comes the article, No Terminal 3 in the Works for RDU. As a governing board at Raleigh-Durham International Airport was being briefed on a new Terminal 1 plan, a question came up. Instead of the $500 million in proposed renovations to Terminal 1, which could increase the gate count from 9 to 21, why not implement an entirely new terminal? Bill Sandifer, chief operating officer of the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority, admits staff has considered the possibility of a Terminal 3, but that it is far too expensive. While the Terminal 1 revamp project proposed on October 8 would require relocating a chunk of infrastructure to accommodate new gate construction, think the entire baggage system, a new terminal would be exorbitantly expensive, he says. Think parking, curbside entrances, accesses, sidewalks on top of the actual terminal. For the foreseeable future, expect just Terminals 1 and 2, Sandifer says, though he admits that if designing Terminal 1 today, we certainly wouldn't design it this way. And under the heading of last year comes the article, Durham Tech President to Retire After a Long Run. Durham Technical Community College has quietly had a remarkable run, and now its long-time president is retiring. Bill Ingram, who's been at the school since 1983 and president since 2008, will step down next summer. Under his leadership, Durham Tech has steadily expanded, recently announced a $5 million capital campaign that already has $3.5 million. As I reflect on the past 12 years as president, I'm gratified by what we've accomplished, Ingram said in a letter to the school's board of trustees. And under the heading of positive trend comes the article, New Survey Details, Growth of Venture Capital in NC. A new survey shows some positive trends for venture capital in the Triangle. BIP Capital, a VC firm in Atlanta, found that the rate of maturation in the Southeast is exceeding that of the innovation hubs in the San Francisco, New York City, and Boston markets. The report finds that businesses raising $1 million in the Southeast have more revenue traction than those in the innovation hubs. The trend is an important one for the Triangle, as companies here have long felt it was difficult to find funding and need to look outside the market for investment capital. We can claim maturity in the Triangle, says Mark Flickinger, Chief Operating Officer of BIP. There's a constant supply and demand, and deals get done. While he notes there are always more companies that want to be funded than can be funded, the report notes that across the Southeast, there are more investors deploying capital than in the past. The report lists $6.7 billion invested in North Carolina startups since 2014 and 1,518 investments. Mississippi, by comparison, had $36 million and 48 investments. South Carolina, $560 million over 442 deals. And finally, on the biz page, under the heading of New Approaches, comes the article, In College Towns, Managing Traffic is Key for Businesses. Now, Raleigh's about to debut a new effort to manage parking along Hillsborough Street, and Chapel Hill is weighing options along Franklin Street as well. In Raleigh, new parking meters will be installed along Hillsborough Street this month as the city looks to create more space for visitors along the corridor. The meters currently run from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Once the new meters are installed, the times will switch from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. It's a small but significant change. In theory, an NC State University student could snag a parking spot at 5 p.m., hang out in the library till midnight, and never spend a nickel. And that doesn't help. The Hillsborough Street business is thirsting for customers. Over in Chapel Hill, the town is also looking at options to increase the vibrancy of its Franklin Street district. Matt Gladick, the executive director of the Chapel Hill Downtown Partnership, tells Biz that one option is a new parking deck on the west end of Franklin Street. It can be difficult to find a parking spot there. Gladick also would like to see some of the surface lots disappear and be replaced by development, which he says tends to bring people out. Another goal is to reduce the speed of traffic on Franklin Street, perhaps by turning it into a three-lane road with a center turning lane. If you concentrate a lot of restaurants in one space, people are more likely to come. If they can't go to one, then it's a short walk to another, he says. We're social animals. We want to go to places where there's a lot of excitement, a lot of people, and a bunch more business, which is what both areas want. Now we turn the page to the economic development and tech pages of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of Growing comes the article, Captive Air to Expand Youngville Plant. With the addition of a new product line, a Triangle-based manufacturer is expanding. Captive Air CEO Robert Luddy confirms what's already outlined in permit filings. The company is expanding its Youngsville plant, which currently houses 145 employees. By doubling the size of its second building to nearly 70,000 square feet, Captive Air plans to hire at least another 25 people, Luddy says. The company, which he says crossed $500 million in sales last year, is expanding many of its plants around the country. All our plants are expanding based on continued sales growth, Luddy says, adding that the integration of HVAC systems coupled with the introduction of new technologies is driving the numbers. And under the heading, a few details yet, comes the article, Epic Games Planning for Major Expansion in Cary. More than a year after filing permits to make way for a headquarters expansion in Cary, Epic Games confirms it's moving forward with an even bigger plan. A facility ranging up to 500,000 square feet with building activities expected to begin in 2020. That's bigger than the three-story, 93,000 square foot building outlined in a water permit application in 2018. Few specifics were available about the current plan other than a company statement that referenced a range of amenities, outdoor features, and additional parking. At this time, we are not available for interviews, company spokesman Brian Sharon said in an email. We're not currently prepared to share renderings. The company did release a fact sheet that contains a few logistical details, such as confirmation that Epic plans to build at the corner of Crossroads Boulevard and Jones Franklin Road at a site it has owned since 2015. And under the heading of Behind the Deal comes the article, Records Show North Carolina Discussed Incentives to Get Cree to Keep Full $1 Billion Investment in Durham. Prior to Cree's announcement that he would shift part of an expansion plan to New York instead of Durham, North Carolina, economic developers were working on an incentives package of their own to keep the full investment, NC Department of Commerce records show. Email correspondence appears to show an increasing sense of urgency leading up to Cree's announcement on September 25th, as officials tried to hold on to what was announced in May, that Cree would invest $1 billion in Durham. Behind the scenes, New York was stepping up with its offer, record show, and the space Cree could utilize near Utica would provide far more capacity, as explained by Brad Cohn, Cree General Counsel, on August the 2nd, in an email to North Carolina Commerce Secretary Tony Copeland. Cohn told Copeland the layout of the building tapped for the fabrication plant wasn't ideal, but the company could make certain compromises if necessary. That came as Cree's CEO Greg Lowe had reached out to Copeland referencing incentives. In the end, New York's incentives, to the tune of $500 million, helped it win half of Cree's promised investment. And finally, on the economic development page, under the heading of Key Advocate, comes the article, Why North Carolina Deploys Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst. Public records show that, even as the now-closed IBM deal was heating up, Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst continued to advocate for economic development in the Triangle, communicating frequently with business recruiters working to lure big companies to North Carolina. A review of emails between Whitehurst and Chris Chung, CEO of the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, showcases Whitehurst as a frequent resource for the organization. I wanted to give you a heads up that we may be asking you if you can meet with a CEO of a large tech company, Chung wrote March 1st. The names of both the CEO and company, along with the details of the investment being considered, were redacted from the records provided by EDPNC at the behest of a public records request. Whitehurst quickly agreed to Chung's request, responding to Sun on Sunday, March the 3rd. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate your willingness to help with the redacted mentioned. Could be a big one, Chung replied the same day. It's a pattern of communication that appears to repeat itself, such as an exchange in January where, despite travels to Boston, Whitehurst was quick to respond to a request for a favor. Whitehurst, who led Red Hat through its recent $34 billion buyout by IBM, has helped the state win projects before. When Trilliant Networks, for example, was considering moving its headquarters out of California, it was the personal lobbying of Whitehurst that helped seal its investment in Cary. Next, we turn to the healthcare and education page in the Triangle Business Journal for the week, and we find the article, Triangle's Innovate Biopharmaceuticals Plans to Merge with Israel-based RDD Pharma. The merger of a Triangle public drug maker and an Israeli outfit led by former Salix leadership could have huge potential for Raleigh and its gastrointestinal, or GI, therapeutics. Innovate Biopharmaceuticals has announced a merger with Israel-based RDD Pharma in a deal that could bring as much as $25 million to a new Raleigh company, as well as new leadership and investors. The combined company, 9 Meters Biopharmas, will be based in Raleigh out of Innovate's current offices. It will be led by RDD CEO John Temperato, a former senior vice president at Salix Pharmaceuticals, who helped build it prior to its $16 billion acquisition to Valeant in 2015. The company's new board will also be led by RDD's current board chairman, Mark Sirgo. Sirgo, a former board member of Salix, is the CEO of Aruna Bio and vice chairman of Raleigh-based BioDelivery Sciences International. Innovate's current executive chairman, Sandeep Lamas, will continue to serve as a board member of the new company. Innovate will acquire all outstanding stock of RDD in exchange for newly issued shares of its own stock, which will represent about 19.5% of its total. At closing, former Innovate stockholders are expected to win approximately 58.5% of the company, and RDD stockholders will own at least 41.5% of the combined company's capital stock. RDD will offer an initial tranche of $10 million, though the investment could be as high as $25 million by the closing of the deal. The company intends to continue trading on NASDAQ markets. Temperato says the company's investment is largely led by New York-based OrbiMed Advisors. He says RDD was attracted to Innovate because of its existing pipeline, including the first-ever Phase 3 trial for a celiac disease treatment and access to the public markets. Innovate says it was attracted to the deal for access to private capital and leadership expertise. What we were looking for was bringing on board a new CEO with a great track record, Lomas said. And second was bringing in large institutional investors. And thirdly, bringing in a pipeline that adds to our overall story. That creates a combined company that's not just a GI company, but a platform from where we can grow dramatically. And under the heading of honored comes the article, Duke Leader and Alumnus Earns Nobel Prize. A Duke University trustee has earned the Nobel Prize for his work on how cells sense oxygen in the body. William Kalin, one of Duke's newest trustees, is being awarded the Nobel Prize for Physiology and Medicine. He's receiving the award in recognition of his discoveries of how cells sense and adapt to oxygen availability. Kalin is sharing the award with Oxford University's Peter Ratcliffe and Johns Hopkins University Professor Greg Semenza. Semenza completed his residency in pediatrics at Duke. Kalin, who earned his bachelor's degree from Duke, joined the university's board in July. He's a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and is a physician at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Kalin said that while he knew they would be announcing a winner, he wasn't prepared to hear his name. Every scientist in the world dreams of this possibility and knows what today is. But if you're realistic, you don't think it's really going to happen, he said. And in the article under the heading Investment, Code School to use new funds to accelerate its work. A Durham-based coding school plans to use a new investment round to enhance its work on client-based consulting, a quickly developing branch of its business it believes best serves its expansion plans. Momentum Learning, the brainchild of two former Iron Yard executives, has announced a $3.6 million fundraising series led by the investment arm of Clarkston Consulting. Momentum CEO Jessica Mitch says Clarkston invested about $2.75 million and the remaining $85,000 came from existing seed investors. Mitch, Iron Yard's former executive director of growth and strategic partnerships, co-founded the school in 2017 with Clinton Dreisbach, a former instructor and director of academics at Iron Yard. She says the company's graduated just over 100 students from its courses and will keep expanding. That part of the business is growing well, and it's steady, she says. Looking ahead, Mitch says the company is concentrating more on how it can work closely with companies and organizations on talent strategies and maintaining technical talent for existing staff. A consulting-like role, she says, complements its newest investor. That's why, of course, Clarkston Consulting is such an interesting partner for us and somebody we're really excited to pair with, she says. Next, we turn to the real estate page, and we find under the heading of Relocating, the article, Fintech Firm Takes a Floor at Durham ID for its new headquarters. The Durham Innovation District has landed its latest company seeking space for a headquarters, with a local financial technology firm taking a full floor. Spreedly will relocate its headquarters from its current 10,000-square-foot office on Foster Street in Durham, with plans to make the move in the spring. The new space will be 25,000 square feet on the fourth floor of the seven-story Durham ID building at 300 Morris Street in downtown. Spreedly specializes in software that helps online merchants build payment systems. A core mission of Spreedly is to offer an enriching workplace experience for current and future employees, says Spreedly CEO Justin Benson. Our new headquarters at Durham ID delivers that with a superb location and the amenities we want to attract more great talent as we rapidly grow. In 2015, the company announced it had raised $3 million in investments and employed around 12 people. Spreedly has grown to around 65 employees. That's up 40% from a year ago. Molly Glasgow and Ryan Lawrence with JLL represented Spreedly on the lease. And Neil Sharon and Matthew Goodrich represented the landlord, Longfellow Real Estate Partners. And under the heading of apartment comes the article, Rents Remain on the Rise. And here's a list of the hottest submarkets. Apartment rental rates continue to rise in the Triangle as population growth and a booming economy make way for soaring demand. Triangle rates rose 6.5% over the past year, apartmentdata.com says, now averaging $1,165 a month and $1.20 per square foot. Occupancy rates have reached 92.4%, with around 4,100 units absorbed over the past year. Just 3,100 new units open in the same period of time. Across the region, developers have begun working on 28 communities, totaling 6,476 units, and 48 projects with 13,163 units being proposed. ApartmentData.com also looked at rental rate growth and absorption in 22 Triangle area submarkets over the past 3 months to determine which spots are the hottest. So for September, Crabtree Valley in Northwest Raleigh, that's $1.23 per square foot monthly rental rate, 13.6% annualized growth, 1.5% of market absorbed. In Briar Creek, that's $1.15 per square foot monthly rate, 11.4% annualized growth, 2.8% of market absorbed. The New Bern Avenue Knightdale area, $1.11 per square foot monthly rate, 13.4% annualized growth with 1.5% of market absorbed. In downtown Durham, Duke University, that's $1.58 per square foot monthly rate, 7.8% annualized growth, 2.9% of market absorbed. Research Triangle Park, $1.23 per square foot monthly rate, 13.6% annualized growth, 0.7% of market absorbed. And finally, in the University Drive Durham Chapel Hill Boulevard area, $1.19 per square foot monthly rate, 18.4% annualized growth, 0.6% of market absorbed. Now we turn to the restaurants and retail page briefly. And under the heading of Wine and Dine comes the article, North Carolina Wine Celebrated at Cary Event. NC Fine Wines, the nonprofit that helps promote North Carolina wine and provides funds to students pursuing careers in enology and viticulture in the state, just finished its fine wine showcase events at Heron's Restaurant inside Cary's Umstead Hotel and Spa. The five-course meal featured seven North Carolina wineries, such as Sanctuary Vineyards, Jones Vondrail Vineyards and Winery, Jolo Winery and Vineyards, Herrera Vineyards, and Raffaldini Vineyards. The Umstead was the last stop of the wine and food pairing tour, which catered to over 600 guests from Asheville, Charlotte, Winston-Salem, and Pinehurst. Diana Jones, co-owner of Jones Vondrail Vineyards, discussed the winery's Rosé Dia, a rosé-style wine that has won the best rosé in the North Carolina Fine Wines Competition 3 years in a row. The wine was paired with a butternut squash soup with spiced pecans, ruby port, and apple onion jam. J.W. Ray, owner and winemaker of the Jolo Winery in Pilot Mountain, spoke to the crowd of 70 guests about how important it is to drink local. He explained that with North Carolina wines, all the grapes are produced in the state, which isn't the case with many North Carolina breweries and distilleries who get ingredients such as hops and grain from outside of the Tar Heel state. And also on the restaurant page under the heading of Knightdale comes the article, Texas-themed steakhouse opens its first North Carolina location. A Texas-based restaurant chain has opened a location in Knightdale. Saltgrass Steakhouse opened October the 8th at 6601 Knightdale Boulevard at the Shops at Midway Plantation, just east of Interstate 540. Saltgrass describes itself as an authentic steakhouse famous for its flavorful steaks. The menu features steaks, fresh seafood, chicken, burgers, sandwiches, salads, ribs, and more. In addition, all soups and salad dressings are made in-house. The name dates back to the 1800s when cattle were driven to the Texas Gulf Coast to graze on the coastal grass. "We're thrilled and honored to join the Knightdale community," said Ken Pierce, Divisional Vice President with Saltgrass. The restaurant's design invokes the atmosphere of a hill country home. The dining room features wood furnishings and leather seating. The Knightdale restaurant will be open 7 days a week. Saltgrass has over 86 locations throughout Alabama, Arkansas, Colorado, Florida, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, Nevada, Oklahoma, and Texas. The Knightdale restaurant is its first in North Carolina. Now we come to the cover story of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and it's entitled How Ted Klink Rose to the Top at Tywood's. Ted Klink wasn't looking for a job when he arrived for a lunch meeting in Atlanta with then Highwoods Property CEO Ed Fritch 8 years ago. Klink was then serving as a principal at Atlanta-based Goddard Investment. "I wasn't actively looking for an opportunity, but I knew of Highwoods' reputation and I knew of Ed. So I took the lunch," Klink says. "Turned out to be the best career move I've made." The two met at Food 101, a longtime food-to-table eatery in Atlanta. Fritch let him know they were looking for a new executive, one with CEO potential. 1 hour turned into two, then three, and by the time they were done, Klink knew he was interested. "I remember driving home thinking, how am I going to tell my wife I'm interested in pursuing this job," he says. After that lunch in Atlanta, Highwoods reached out to continue the interviews. So in 2012, Klink joined the company as its new Senior Vice President and Chief Investment Officer. In Klink, Fritch found an accomplished real estate veteran with nearly two decades of experience in the industry and billions of dollars in deals done, all while maintaining a strong network of friends and mentors throughout the country. Highwoods found a future leader. In September, Klink took on the role of president and CEO, the first time a non-native of Raleigh was tapped to lead one of the largest real estate investment trusts in the Southeast. And it comes at a critical time for the company as it builds on the culture Fritch instilled while targeting new and potentially lucrative markets. The $4.6 billion company has re-entered the Charlotte market and announced it would exit to two others, all while construction costs continue to skyrocket and the economy delves deeper into the longest cycle of expansion in the nation's history. Klink, 53, is a taller-than-average, clean-cut Midwesterner from a small town 3 hours west of Chicago. Personable and unassuming, he grew up in the farming town of Galesburg, Illinois, population 25,000. There, Klink had a front row seat to the world of business and finance with a father who worked as a banker and later owned a car dealership. In high school, a friend talked him into visiting Southern Methodist University in Dallas, then the epicenter of an ongoing real estate boom, and Klink was hooked. He majored in real estate and finance and within a year landed his first real estate experiences working as an intern at a new tenant representation firm called Fisher & Company, owned and operated by serial entrepreneur Mike Latham. "I was there for three of my 4 years at SMU," Klink says. "Absolutely loved it. Every day was different. You get out and interact with people and all that. Really dynamic business. I really caught the bug." Working as an intern, Klink spent hours cold calling clients and knocking on doors, looking to get the fledgling firm in front of as many prospective tenants as possible. Latham quickly became a mentor. "Ted was incredible," Latham says. "He was eager to learn, clearly smart, and put together the constructs that were important to understand in order to do well, and he was willing to do the hard work. Often, that meant sitting in a room for hours, cold calling clients, or stomping through high-rises, knocking on doors." Latham says it wasn't glamorous. "With hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of young folks I've hired, Ted was a shining star." But by the time Klink graduated from SMU, the real estate rush in Texas had ended. "I would have loved to stay in Dallas, but the real estate market had turned," he says. "Real estate was overbuilt, and there weren't that many opportunities." So Klink found a job in Charlotte at what is now Bank of America as a part of its real estate lending program. From there, he moved to Atlanta, where his then-girlfriend, now-wife Stephanie, lived after SMU. Klink picked up his MBA in finance and real estate at the University of Georgia soon got a job at Atlanta's Equitable Real Estate. Equitable had recently launched a program hiring UGA grads fresh out of the MBA program. Among the people behind that program was Marcus Jackson, now a principal at Avison Young in Raleigh. At the time, Equitable Real Estate managed $35 billion worth of real estate assets, and we were clearly the biggest real estate asset manager in the country, Jackson says. Ted, as I recall, was our first hire in the MBA program. Klink established himself, and his responsibilities began to grow. He's been a fast riser ever since MBA school, Jackson says. Truly a fast riser. That was 1993. Also on the rise, Highwoods in Raleigh. Highwoods Properties began in 1978 with an inaugural purchase of 122 acres in North Raleigh and grew as the years went on. The company started out with only a handful of principals and real estate professionals. One was Rex Thomas, a businessman and newly minted real estate professional who headed the company's property management wing. It was a small company, started a year before, he says. By 1986 or 87, we were the largest third-party services company in the Triangle. The real estate crash in Texas that sent Klink east also sent crowds of brokers, developers, and all manner of real estate professionals to Raleigh in search of the next boom town. And Highwoods was there to cater to all their needs. Among its growing staff was 23-year-old Ed Fritch, who joined in 1982. In June of 94, the company went public. The company rode the wave of growth until the 1990s, when the industry began slowing down and banks started offloading their real estate portfolios. We struggled through it, Thomas says. At the time, Fritch was over a decade into his tenure at Highwoods, and in 1998, he was named Chief Operating Officer. Fritch took over as CEO in July 2004. By then, Klink hadn't left his company, but his business cards kept changing, as did his growing responsibilities. A few years after joining Equitable Real Estate, he switched from handling loans and project financing to working in acquisition, buying and selling real estate for clients, and was quickly rising in the ranks and building relationships with the leadership. Then in 1997, the company was acquired by Lendlease, an Australian real estate firm. Klink continued to excel, and in 2003, Lendlease was acquired by Morgan Stanley. David Hartman was then a managing director and head of U.S. real estate investing at Morgan Stanley. Hartman supervised Klink's division. He really progressed. He was identified early on as a smart investor, a person of real integrity and team spirit, Hartman says. He's an individual that doesn't come around that often. Klink rose to managing director. Essentially, the head of acquisitions for the U.S. real estate businesses, Hartman says. He produced a very large volume, he and his staff, well in excess of $1 billion of acquisitions. Klink was, in effect, the manager of the entire Atlanta operation. Following his success there, Klink moved to an Atlanta's Goddard Investment Group in 2009. Back in Raleigh, Fritch had been CEO for 8 years, and while retirement was still some years away, he began laying the groundwork for succession. When he became CEO, Fritch immediately began work on the company's new strategic plan, a 132-page document that guides the company to this day. It wasn't just a plan we put together and said, well, we did a strategic plan, and then 10 years later dust it off, and from a historian's perspective say, what's this, Fritch says. Theoretically, if you got back to your desk and you had 3 phone calls, the plan told you which one to return first. The pillars of the plan: portfolio, balance sheet, communications, and people. The plan also laid out clear objectives and metrics to ensure company officials knew whether it was being followed. It meant taking a hard look at all properties and jettisoning the ones that weren't working while bolstering those that were. With each street address that we have, try and identify if it's core or non-core. And is it going to be core over time or not? And if it's not, we look to the disposition of that, Fritch says. If it's core, we keep it and keep it well maintained and enhance it. We look at new markets the same way. Markets were targeted if they had better than national average population growth, lower than the average cost of living, better than average quality of life, and so on. Meanwhile, on the balance sheet side, officials minimized debt. We've dramatically reduced the amount of debt the company bears today, Fritz says. We own 232 buildings, and one has a loan on it. That's a dramatic difference from where we were. That allows us to be much more nimble with our portfolio. Nearly 10 years into the plan, Highwoods decided to form a search committee for Fritz's successor. That's how the lunch at Food 101 in Atlanta came about, and Fritz met Klink, still at Goddard, and with no plans to leave Atlanta. After that first meeting, talks continued. Fritz made it clear that he was looking for a potential successor. I said, I'm not going to be there forever, and we need somebody who can step into the role at some point in time, and I hope you can be the candidate for that, Fritz says. And he did, and it didn't take 7.5 years to figure that out. From his onboarding in 2012 and for the next 7 years, he had worked closely with Fritz and the senior staff, continuing to execute the strategic plan. Meanwhile, the markets continued to change. The plan continued to call the company to invest heavily in the best business districts, or BBDs, and in many markets. These were becoming increasingly urban. Among the highlights in those years, Highwoods landed contracts to build the MetLife Global Technology Campus in Cary and the tire maker Bridgestone's U.S. headquarters in downtown Nashville, Tennessee. In August, the company announced its return to the Charlotte market with the purchase of the Bank of America Tower, the 33-story building at the 10-acre Legacy Union site in uptown Charlotte. Highwoods agreed to purchase the building in a $436 million deal that's expected to close in November. We're incredibly excited to move back into Charlotte, Klink says. Charlotte's been at the top of our new market wish list for many years. The company left that market in 2005. To match the cost of the tower purchase, the company will sell off a portfolio of assets in Memphis, Tennessee, and Greensboro, and it plans to ultimately close its offices in those two markets following the sale of its remaining assets. Of the company's then nine markets, Memphis and Greensboro made up the two smallest in terms of percentage of revenue per market at 5.4% and 4.9% respectively. The next month, Klink was named president and CEO of Highwoods, its third CEO since it went public, and he hit the ground running. The first month of his tenure saw a $400 million public offering, an investor conference, and rating agencies meetings. The stock prices crept up in that time, inching up from $43.21 at the close of August to $43.62 as of October 9th. This does represent a slight decline from last year, when Highwoods traded at $46.08 in early October of 2018. Asked what's next, Klink keeps the details vague, saying little more than to expect more of the same. The strategy has been in place for a long time, he says. The core tenets of the plan are going to remain the same. Meanwhile, with so many positive indicators, Highwoods isn't immune to the headwinds developers around the country face, construction costs. That would be one issue we face daily, Klink says, and it's been a headwind for probably the past 6 years. Highwoods officials tracking the industry say costs are rising about 0.5% every month for a 6% annual spike. It's a challenge. So can we justify to get rental rates that justify new development, he says. Thankfully, the tailwind we have is our southeast markets are growing materially faster than the rest of the country. So jobs are coming here and need new modern office space. We've been able to see the rental rates increase to justify the new construction cost increases. Finally, Klink says perhaps the most important thing he can do is focus on the people making up Highwoods teams and preserve Fritz's investment in building a great place to work. First and foremost, maintain the culture Ed's created, he said. Ed's been here 37 years. That's a hard thing to step into. But I think we've got the right team in place to do just fine. After all these years, Klink still makes his way back to Atlanta, the company's second biggest market, for business and to see friends whenever he has a chance. But he'll have to find a new place to eat. For after 20 years, Food 101 closed its doors in March. And frequent listeners to this program will know that right after the cover story, we usually encounter the executive voice column. And this week continues with that pattern. And this week's executive voice belongs to Kyle Raneke. The article is entitled, Hranicki Ascends to Key Wells Fargo Job, Says Triangle is Growth Market. Kyle Hranicki is new at the job, technically. Hranicki, a 25-year veteran at Wells Fargo, was appointed head of commercial banking for the California Bank a year ago. Hranicki would lead a newly restructured organization where business, government, and institutional, as well as the middle market segment, would be combined under one commercial banking organization. The move put him in charge of more than 6,000 employees across 80 markets. Now, regional leaders from Irvine, California to Charlotte all report to Hranicki. And Hranicki, recently in Raleigh for a town hall and charity event, says that all's well so far. And that's particularly true in Raleigh, where Wells Fargo continues to dominate deposits according to the FDIC. We're really good at just basic relationship banking, Hranicki says. We've always had a culture of allowing our market leaders enough discretion to make decisions, to have autonomy, to make decisions they need to in the market to be successful. Add that to a national product and service base, and Wells has an advantage. Hranicki says it's the history, however, that has created loyal customers. We've been here for over 100 years, he says. We don't want to lose that market share. We're proud of it. It's something we take seriously. This is an important market. This is a growing market, and we feel like we can continue to grow. Hranicki says another thing Wells can do in the Raleigh market is bring business-specific expertise. Its organization has experts in industry-specific banking. And two of particular relevance in Raleigh are life sciences and technology. As John Ward, market executive for commercial banking in Raleigh, points out, the bank also has the capabilities to grow with the company's needs. We have a lot of technology and life sciences companies that are raising capital, that are ultimately accessing the capital markets, and there are commercial bankers who can come in and work with those customers, he said. And as Hranicki notes, there are other groups, such as corporate and investment banking, that can swoop in when customers want to go public or raise debt in the capital markets. But Hranicki acknowledges the competition. While Wells Fargo maintained its number one seat when it came to deposits in Raleigh, community banks were chipping away at its share. Hranicki says Wells doesn't plan to shy away from competition. I think competition makes you better, he says. And that includes J.P. Morgan Chase, which recently opened a retail branch in Chapel Hill and plans another imminent location in Raleigh, the start of its local investment, the bank has said. This is such a dynamic market, Hranicki says. We see opportunity to grow, too. I mean, look, would it be great if they didn't come here? Sure, but you know, I think we're pretty comfortable with where we stand. We have to keep earning their business every day, even without them entering the market. One big change is coming to Wells, however, and that's the new chief executive. The bank recently named Charles Scharf as CEO. And although Hranicki hasn't yet met him, he's excited at what the new CEO symbolizes, a new chapter. It feels like a major milestone for the bank, just the ability to move forward with a new leader. It's super exciting for us, he says. I'm personally pleased. In the meantime, Hranicki's job isn't changing. Hranicki estimates he spends 80% of his time on the road. It's his second visit to Raleigh since taking on his new job, and he expects to be back. That's my favorite part of the job, he says. It's to go around and meet people, hear from our bankers, hear what's on their mind, talk to them about what we're up to. Hranicki says collaboration has become key to his management style. When he started in his new role, his team set up an email box, a venue where our team could send in ideas. It's been a big part of how we've shaped what we've done, he said. We're trying to create a culture of continuous improvement. Hranicki began as a commercial banker, an analyst for the bank. From there, he served through multiple roles, including the Debt Capital Markets Group, helping bankers originate larger syndicate loans. Then he ran the energy business at the bank for nearly a decade before shifting to corporate banking. I don't know that when I walked in that door, I would have thought I'd be sitting at this seat or be here 25 years later, he says. Next, we turn to the small business page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and in it, Jim Verdonik writes, "Being willing to fail can be essential to ultimate success." A recent story about a West Coast venture capital manager raises interesting questions about entrepreneurial culture. After alt school, a company that had raised over $170 million, announced it was closing down. A VC tweeted that he always knew Alt School was doomed and was glad his firm had passed on the deal. That unleashed a barrage of tweets chastising the VC and a boycott of the VC's firm. I dislike know-it-alls who criticize with 20/20 hindsight as much as the next guy. But the Twitter outrage shows that criticizing failure is a major cultural taboo. Question: is banning public discussion about failure a good or bad thing? Proponents for putting failure in a taboo category argue that fear is a major impediment to people striving to implement new ideas. Supporting risk-taking and accepting failure as a normal part of the learning process creates more dynamic and creative economies than discouraging risk-taking and punishing failure. The success of Silicon Valley is based on entrepreneurs and investors overcoming their fear of failure. So maybe it's logical for communities to use social pressure to ban anything that hints of public criticism of failure. Others might say that fear is a useful tool. The absence of fear often produces unrealistic thinking. Failure brings pain and suffering to many people. Investors lose money. People are fired. Tomorrow isn't always a better day for everyone when a business fails, as much as we might wish it so. That happens whether we talk about it or not, so why not talk about it? Is there a way to balance these two views? What's the best mix in a community between encouraging risk-taking and encouraging prudence? Personally, I think failure is a lot like pain. A good workout involves stretching yourself in many small ways and not giving up when you start to feel the burn. But I've never been a no-pain, no-gain exerciser. Real pain is a warning sign that you may be doing permanent damage. That's why many professional athletes have crippling injuries after they retire. The secret to healthy exercise is pushing yourself just short of where you start damaging your body. Is there a way to do that with risk-taking and failure? As a lawyer who advises entrepreneurs and startups, I see a lot of people who have been burned by launching businesses that fail. Sometimes they stay in the business too long because they don't want to admit they failed. That can lead to lost savings, lost opportunities, and even divorces. So in counseling clients, I try to take a balanced approach, encourage people starting new businesses, but test their ideas to be sure they are reality-based. Sometimes that requires telling people to go back to the drawing board because their business won't fly. Providing the right balance is an art. I'm always looking for ways to do it better. How do you balance dealing with your fear of failing versus your optimism that you can change the world? How do you bring a dose of reality to people without scaring them away from risk-taking? Now we've reached the viewpoint of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and the guest column this week is written by Alan Berube. Berube's a senior fellow and deputy director at the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings. His column is entitled, Quietly, Black Household Income on the Rise. Headlines around the recent release of new Census Bureau data spotted a continued rise in income inequality. The GINI index, that's a statistical measure of income inequality, rose to its highest recorded level in 50 years, signaling that the distribution of income in the United States is the most uneven it's been since the Bureau began tracking it in 1967. That disturbing trend, however, masks the economic progress black households have made in recent years. In 2018, their median household income, that's the level at which half the households have higher incomes and half lower, reached $41,511. While that level only slightly exceeded that from 2017, it continued to top 2007's pre-recession peak for black median household income of $41,134. Equally promising was the geographically widespread increase in incomes black households experienced. Of the 50 metropolitan areas with the largest black populations, 18 registered a statistically significant increase in median income for those households between 2013 and 2018. In 31 of those metro areas, the estimated change was positive, though not significantly different statistically from zero, due to sample size and variation in the American Community Survey. Metro areas in the West and South recorded the largest statistically significant increases in black median household income. San Francisco and Seattle topped the list, with their typical black households earning at least 30% more in 2018 than in 2013. Phoenix, Riverside, California, Tampa, and Orlando were among other Sunbelt metro areas where black households experienced large income gains across that five-year period. Meanwhile, the five metropolitan areas with the largest black populations, New York, Atlanta, Chicago, Dallas, and Washington, D.C., also saw black median household incomes rise significantly from rates of 7% in greater D.C. to 21% in greater Atlanta. What accounts for this progress in black incomes? One likely factor is increased employment opportunity. The share of prime age, that's 25 to 54-year-old black adults in jobs, increased significantly in 38 of the 50 metro areas from 2013 to 2018. In the metro areas with the largest increases in black median household incomes, employment rates for black adults rose anywhere from 5.6 percentage points, that's Riverside, California, to an astonishing 12.7 percentage points in San Francisco during that period. There was a positive, significant association between the change in black employment rates and black median household incomes across metro areas from 2013 to 2018. In metro areas such as Augusta, Georgia, and Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a strong regional economy may have succeeded in helping unemployed black workers off the sidelines, but largely into lower-paying jobs that fail to boost typical standards of living for black households. In other metro areas, income and employment trends for black residents may reflect not only improving outcomes, but also changing local populations. In the San Francisco metro area, for example, the number of black households declined by about 10,000 from 2013 to 2018. Jumps in Bay Area income and employment for black adults may reflect that decline, if rising costs of living have pushed out some lower-income black households to other regions. Notwithstanding these complex underlying patterns from 2013 to 2018, most major metropolitan areas registered estimated increases in black median household income that exceeded those for white households. Across the 20 metro areas with the largest black populations, where sample sizes are larger, 15 registered a larger estimated rise in median black income than median white income. Of course, substantial gaps remain between black and white median incomes in most major metro areas. In 2018, the typical white household in Sunbelt areas, such as Phoenix, Riverside, and Tampa, had an income 20% to 40% higher than the typical black household. In northern metro areas such as Milwaukee, Minneapolis, and Cleveland, that median income gap was much higher, between 120 and 140%. Many of these metro areas exhibit extremely high rates of racial and economic segregation, which limits upward mobility for low-income families, in part by reinforcing racist structures that devalue black neighborhoods. Recent progress, fortunately, suggests that these patterns are not immutable. Policies that support a tight labor market, improved access for black workers to higher-paying sectors and occupations, and greater affordability in high-cost areas can ensure that major metropolitan economies support continued income gains for black households in the years ahead. Now we get to this week's editor's notebook, and here's the editor's column entitled WeWork Woes Create Developers' Nightmare. About 2 years ago, when we first started noticing WeWork signing big leases with developers building new shiny buildings in Raleigh and Durham, we started wondering about WeWork's business model. Essentially, WeWork signs the master contract for the lease with the developer of the building, then breaks it into several pods by renting it out to startups, companies in need of satellite office space, and short-term project owners. When WeWork filed the initial papers to go public in August, people started looking a little deeper into the financial disclosure for We Companies, that's WeWork's parent company. But more importantly, federal regulators started asking for additional clarifications that led We Company to amend its IPO documents. For example, We Company stated in its IPO documents that the company delivered 273,000 new workstations during the first half of the year. That got amended to 106,000 after the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission's query. The cost to deliver these products and services suddenly went down from $1.3 billion in August to $800 million in the amended filing. These kinds of wild swings in numbers are unforced errors that are now causing company founder Adam Neumann serious headaches. What's worse is that these headaches are about to spill over into the development community. Developers who cut deals with WeWork better hope that We Company is able to complete the IPO, because billions more are tied to the IPO in the form of bank financing from WeWork's original financial partner, SoftBank. The company currently loses so much cash that it needs to keep that income growing while it builds up the space it leases. But if it struggles to get new money, that likely will disrupt the entire income cycle, which could eventually affect the developers who signed big leases with them. A Raleigh developer looking to build a downtown Raleigh tower recently said his New York financier will not accept WeWork as a tenant because of the credit risk. Another potential storm surrounds WeWork's typical client. If the seed and venture capital markets dry up, the first batch of companies to go out of business would be the startups. The U.S. consumer is keeping the economy going, and with the holiday season a couple of months away, we most likely will have a solid fourth quarter in terms of retail sales. Will the companies that trade on Wall Street disclose soft earnings, or will they continue to show strength in their pipeline? We don't have to wait too long. In just a few days, earnings seasons will be well underway. For now, however, the WeWork development cries for additional scrutiny as the entire commercial real estate industry cautiously watches the IPO saga. And by the end of the year, this could be one of the biggest business stories of 2019. And this week's business survey pulse is the question, how do you expect the Panthers season to play out? And 49% think it's going to be a losing season. And 42% say, hey, we're going to make the playoffs as a wild card. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have comments or questions, call us 919-832-5138. So long.